everyone. My name is Jessica, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is November 14th of 2000, which means I am coming up on an anniversary here shortly. And I have a home group, Harbor City Speakers Group. I assure you that I didn't pick that group. It was picked for me to be my home group. I thought they were all obnoxious when I first met them, and obviously on something, because you can't be that happy and sober at the same time. And let's see, I have a sponsor. I use my sponsor. I meet with my sponsor regularly. I think that's important. If you're going to have one, you might as well use it. And I also sponsor a lot of women. And what I find is that keeps me right in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. And someone like me, that's exactly where I need to be. I have a job here tonight, and that's to tell you guys in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And, you know, when I need to say just for me, I'm not here to impress anybody. I'm here so that I can have another day of sobriety. I'm here so that when I get home, I can put my head on my pillow and fall asleep at night and not have to worry about what you're thinking about me or what he's thinking about me or what I'm going to say to so-and-so tomorrow and, well, they say this, and I'm going to say that, and da-da-da-da-da. And because that's what my brain will do. If I don't do what you people have taught me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I'm from a small town in central Pennsylvania, and there's not a lot going on there. You know, it was me and some mountains, and I grew up in the valley, so we had a little creek in the backyard, and you know, my mom used to say it was our swimming pool, and it was never good enough for me. I always wanted the actual pool, but, you know, I mean, I look back at my childhood now, and I'm like, oh, my God, like, I had it so good. I had it so good and didn't even know it. I mean, I would, you know, I would wake up and just go run and play, climb mountains, swing on the, you know, the monkey vines, go swimming, ice skating on the pond in the winter, and, you know, I had it all. But back then, I couldn't see that. Everything about my childhood growing up, when I was in it, sucked. You know what I mean? I grew up without a father. So, you know, of course, poor me. You know, my mom had an alcoholic boyfriend, and I'd see the bones breaking and furniture flying, glasses shattering, and the screaming and the yelling and the hollering. And I saw the pain. I saw the pain in my mom's eyes. And it wasn't like I was thinking to myself, like, I'm never going to become an alcoholic and do that. But I just remember thinking, like, I didn't want to cause my mom harm. I didn't want to cause her pain. You know, and I wanted my mom to be proud. My father died before I was born from a drug and alcohol overdose. And I tell you that solely for the reason that I was one of those people who was never going to do that stuff. I was never going to drink. I knew what happened. Bad things happened when you did any of that kind of stuff, and I was staying far away from it. You know, and I grew up back when, what was her name? I think Nancy was doing the Just Say No campaign, and I remember that so clearly as a little girl, just like I was never going to do that stuff. I was never going to cause my mom any kind of pain, and I come from, I wouldn't say that I come from poverty, but, I mean, things would have been any worse, we would have been right down there. And we grew up in a trailer, and my mom gave me everything that a little girl needed and then some. But I just couldn't see it, you know, like, you know, the kids in school would have, you know, that Barbie, and I would have, you know, like the $7.99 Barbie, not the $19.99 Barbie, and, you know, so I always had what I needed, but it was never enough, you know, and then I got older, and all the kids would be wearing, like, Gap and Limited, and I would be wearing James Way, and, you know, like, nothing was ever good enough for me, and so, and I tell you that because when I was getting sober, sitting in those chairs, I would hear speakers up here talking about that, talk about how when they were little, and they just didn't feel like they fit, something was just different, something was just off about them, you know, and for me, it's kind of like when you put a puzzle together and you got one piece left and it doesn't fit in the hole that's left in the puzzle, and that's kind of how I felt. You know, like I would clearly be there amongst all you, but I just didn't fit. It just didn't feel right. And I don't know how else to say that. And I guess if you're alcoholic, you understand exactly what I'm trying to say. And, you know, so here I am in the country, you know, I pretend that I'm Laura Ingalls all day long, and, you know, and it's poor me, I don't have a father, I don't have this, I don't have that, and I got old enough and it was time to go into the city. Now, the city is 3 red lights, so not very big, but to me it was a big deal. You know, I'm a country girl, and now I'm going into the city, and, which is clearly just a town, because there's only 3 red lights, and it's just such a big deal to me, and I remember just being so consumed in what, you know, the big city people were going to think of me. And you know, it's late 80s, early 90s, so I'm not real cute. You know, I'm just starting puberty, and I got the frizzy hair. It's one too many perms in it. It's orange because I used Sun In way too much that summer. And you know, I got braces, and my nickname is Flat. I'm short and I'm fat, and so clearly I'm looking goofy. I feel goofy, you know. And I don't have, you know, the cool clothes. And I remember just going into the school and just being terrified, so filled with fear, and you know. I was taking dance classes. I was also, and I look back at it, and I have no idea where the courage came from, but I was a cheerleader. And then I was so full of fear, I don't know how I could get up in front of all those people and dance and cheer and whatnot. But, you know, I guess that was just kind of like what I poured all my energy into, because that's all I did. I didn't have friends. You know, it's not like I grew up, you know, with this circle of friends. Like, I grew up feeling very alone. It was always just me. I was always, you know, playing with a group of guys, a little boy at the time. And so I was the girl that always got beat up, or, you know, they'd want to, you know, body slam me off of the top wire when we played WWF. And, you know, like, I was just always, that's just the way it was for me. Like, I was never the cool girl in the center. I was always on the outside looking in, and I was, you know, and so I'm full of fear, and I'm going into the school, and, you know, so I know now, looking back, like, I was just ripe for a drink. You know, like, that's all was missing from the picture. You know, but back then, I didn't know that. And I remember this group of older guys asked me if I wanted to go out one night, and clearly the answer is yes, when you look like I look and feel like I feel. And they asked me what I wanted to drink, and now, mind you, I never really drank where I felt the effects of alcohol. I had, you know, maybe some sips of, you know, my mom's Ace Vermonte at holidays, or she kept a bottle of peach schnapps in the house, and I'm sure, like, you know, I'd snuck some sips off that, but it tastes peachy, doesn't really do anything. And my mom has told me since that I used to finish off the beer bottles with the, you know, a little bit of backwash at the end. You know, but up until this point, I never really drank, per se. And so I told these guys I wanted to bottle up Bacardi 151. I don't know where that idea came from. I don't know why I thought that was a good idea to drink Bacardi 151, but that's what I told them. And I didn't ask for a chaser. I didn't ask for ice. I didn't ask for a cup. I didn't ask for anything else, just a bottle of Bacardi 151, and that's what the guys got me. And so here I am. It's the big night, and this girl and I, we, you know, we get together, and we're going out, and you know, one of the guys had these keys. There was a nightclub that someone tried to open in my hometown, which went under because everything in my town goes under because it's a small town. And but we had keys, and we went in, and electricity and all that was still hooked up. And I remember the loud music going, the lights were spinning. And I remember where we were standing, you could, like, look down on the dance floor. And I remember, you know, cracking this bottle and, you know, taking that first swig, and, like, it burned. And I remember, like, I wanted to puke, like, almost instantly, you know, and I'm, like, forcing it to stay down because I have to look cool. Can't let the guys know that I don't have a drink. And so I'm forcing this stuff down, and, you know, and I don't know what to do with it. I don't, you know, so I just keep taking swigs off of it, and which is seems to be a pattern for me because that's how I drank. I drank shots, and I drank hard liquor, but, you know, I just kept doing it, and I remember somewhere, I don't know, maybe 3, 4, 5 shots, I have no idea, but somewhere that burning sensation just changed, and I no longer had to force it to stay down, and it just became warm, and something just, I look back, I can clearly see what was happening. Like, my body was reacting to the booze, and, like, my attitude changed. You know, I had a whole new look on life. And I wasn't, you know, short, fat, and flat anymore. I had these voluptuous curves and this beautiful, sleek hair. And I was on that dance floor, and I just remember dancing and having such a good time. I didn't care what anyone thought about me. Which is a big deal for a freshman girl who's out with a bunch of senior guys, you know, to be free and not, like, care what they're thinking about her. And I just, you know, just remember, like, looking at these guys and being like, which one of you is going to be lucky enough to get me, you know? And like, that's not the case for someone like me. You know, I used to always be like, I wonder which one's going to be dumb enough to hit on me. Alcohol just did something to me. And it just made me fit. It just made me okay. And I kind of told you that night that's what was happening. Because I didn't have a clue what was going on. I was just a kid, you know, and I was having a good time. But, you know, from hearing stories in Rooms of AA and being taught a few things, I look back and that was a big deal. Like, that was a big night for me and my drinking. And, you know, and it's important for me to tell you that an hour after taking that first shot, I was in the bathroom hanging my head in the toilet, and I passed out there and came to, you know, a few hours later, and, you know, passed out again and came back to a few more hours later, and then I woke up the next morning and at a place I'd never been before beside a person I'd never met before, and you know, I don't remember thinking, like, oh my God, like, this shouldn't be happening, I shouldn't be here. I just remember thinking, like, oh my God, I had such a great time last night, and just like that. That's what I want. It's like everything in my life just changed. And I just, you know, like I was going down this path of, you know, I was doing really well with this dance and stuff. I was in there 5 nights a week, 4 hours a night. I was like the best dancer. And if I wasn't the best dancer, I'd practice twice as hard and come back the next class and be the best dancer. And it was just like that. I just changed, went this way. And I immediately just chameleoned in to the group of people who were doing what I wanted to do. And you know, to me around this time, it's important that I let you know I met him. It took me 8 years to convince him that I was the one for him. And then I would, you know, wake up beside this guy for the next 2 years and be like, oh my God, what are we doing? Like, I hate you. And so how I convinced him that I was the one is I stalked him. I would chase away any girls that he tried to date and threaten to beat them up. I'd call their parents and, you know, tell them that their girl was out with him. And, you know, like, I was nuts. I was insane. Like, my whole life revolved around drinking and him. And, you know, I stalked him wherever he was. Like, I would just show up, even if I wasn't invited. Like, there I was. I would sit in the alley behind his house and wait for the lights to come on when he would get home at night. And then I'd go climb in the window and just be like, hey, how you doing? And, you know, like, my whole high school career evolved around stalking this guy and drinking half a gallon of vodka every night. Like, that's what I did. I'd sit in my car with my stalker music playing, which was usually some, you know, female vocalist who was, you know, real emotional. And I'd sit there and I'd cry and drink my half gallon of vodka. And I look back at that and I'm like, oh, my God, I was such an idiot. You know, but that's just the truth of the matter, and that's what it was. It was so important to me to have this guy in my life, and you know. And I look back now, and I'm just like, jeez Louise, I was sick. I was very sick. Very sick relationship. But you know, and so for whatever reason, I ended up graduating from high school. And I don't know how I did. I missed more school than I showed up for. And when I was in school, like, I didn't care what was going on. I wasn't showing up to school sober, and you know, I didn't care about anything. I just cared about the next drink. And that's how that's what my life revolved around. It's what it became. And so I graduated from high school and have a decision to make. I can work full-time, get a real job, and become a responsible young adult, which didn't really sound appealing. Or I could go to college, because that's what everybody else was doing. And so I picked a college that was closest to my hometown, so I could be within stalking distance of him. You know, I go off to college, and I don't really remember much about college. You know, it's not like, I wasn't one of those kids that went to college and was like, finally, I'm free. I mean, my mom didn't give me rules. My mom, you know, wasn't very punishing or anything. She just believed that as long as I told the truth and where I was going, what I was doing, she was cool with it and let me do it. And so when I got to college, college wasn't all that much different, other than I was like borrowing money from the government and paying to be there and not doing anything with it. So now here I am, you know, 6 years sober, and I'm $40,000 in debt because I just kept going to college and borrowing money and not doing anything with it. And, you know, so I don't know why Penn State took so long to kick me out, but it wasn't until I was a junior, they're finally like, you got to go. And I flunked out 3 semesters in a row. And, you know, I look back at that, and the only thing that really stands out to me about college is I was one of those girls that was anti-sororities. And I hated everything they stood for and everything about them. And I was one of those girls, like, that used to show up at the parties and, like, try to beat them all up. Or they had, like, they would pick up, like, all the guys would pick up the girls at a certain place, and me and my drunk friend would drive by, and I'd hang out the car with this big, long steel post and try to hit them all when I was drunk. Like, that's just the kind of girl I was. Like, I was just insane. I was mean. I was nasty. I didn't have anything nice to say, and my whole life was about this guy. And, you know, and so he decided it's a good idea to move to Ocean City. I decided it's a good idea to follow, and, you know, so I just show up at the doorstep one day with my suitcase. I'm like, hey, here I am, and, you know, and it was just, it's insanity. Everything about my past was insanity, and I got this job serving drinks on the beach all day long, and then I would go work in the pub all night long and serve more drinks. And, you know, the great thing about waitressing on the beach is if you walk slow enough, the sun will melt the drinks fast enough, and then you have to go get them a new one so you can get the drink, the melted one, on the way back. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I did. And that summer, I guess if there's a line in my story to be crossed, this summer is when the line was crossed. And it's definitely when drinking went from fun to completely insane. You know, when I was living in the country, drinking was a lot of fun. You know, we were just a bunch of kids who were hanging out, having parties, you know, playing spades, listening to music, you know, just being kids, you know, kicking the keg as the sun's coming up, you know, or hanging out beside the train tracks, you know, drinking our 40s, or just driving around. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun. And I'm not going to lie about it, because I had a lot of fun back then, and I don't regret any of that stuff. But at this point in my life, things start to get absolutely insane, and a lot of other things do come into my story at this time that I don't talk about out of respect for AA, so don't anyone get excited on me. No, but it's clear for me to say that, and I need to say it because it brought me to the rooms of AA a lot quicker. You know, because I got sober young. And, you know, so here I am. I'm down in Ocean City. I'm drinking around the clock. I can tell you where I lived and where I worked about that summer, and that's all I remember. And I went back to college. And as a junior, this is the semester that ends all semesters. And the good thing about that is that when you're a junior, the government will lend you a lot of money to go to school and to live off of. So I get this refund check for like $3,000 after my tuition's paid. And I'm looking at this check and I'm thinking, I really like to work. I could probably triple this in like a week. And so I think that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to become my own boss and set up shop. And that's what I did. So I started making daily trips to North Philadelphia. North Philadelphia now, from where I'm living, is a 3-hour trip one way. And I started going every day. And I thought this was completely normal to spend 6 hours driving to get what I needed to get. And so this little idea of mine turns into a 5-year spree. And in those 5 years, I got to meet lots of friendly folks who are authoritative figures, and, you know, people at the DEA, and judges, and counselors, and therapists, and correctional officers. You know, and this is the kind of places I ended up. Like, I come to, and I look around, and, like, you know, I'm surrounded by cement blocks. And I'd be like, oh, my God, like, what am I doing here? Like, I'm a little country girl. What happened? How did I get here? So mom's going to be proud about this one, you know what I mean? And, you know, things like that started happening. I was under investigation by the feds 3 different times, and I thought that just made me cool. And so I thought that did. I'd be sitting in the bars, you know, standing on the bar screaming for someone to give me a drink, and I just thought that I was cool. you know, anything, if there was anything unattractive about it. And truth of the matter is I did what I had to do on a daily basis to get the next drink. I didn't care who got in the way. I didn't care, you know, who got hurt, what harm was caused. I didn't care who I had to steal from. My whole life became like how I was going to get the next drink. And, things started happening, like I get that look of disgust. You know, my mom would come visit me in jail, and she'd be pounding her fist on the cement, and she'd have tears pouring down on her face, and like, why, Jessica, what's wrong with you? Why do you keep doing that? And I don't know about you guys, but I can't answer a question like that. I don't know how, I don't know what's wrong with me, so how can I tell you what's wrong with me? But I can't let you know that I don't know what's wrong with me. And it used to drive me absolutely crazy, and I used to just lay in jail and just wait to get out, just to shut this thing up. Because the idea of being sober was so far, like it just wasn't something I was interested to do. And I got to tell you, when I was growing up, I thought the people who drank were so cool. You know, I'd watch the movies, and I'd see these, you know, cool alcoholics drinking their drinks by their pool, and I'd be like, I can't wait to get old and be like that. And, you know, and so from the door, like, there's obviously something wrong with Jessica. You know, I just can't wait to get old and grown up and drink like a lady, and, like, I know what drinking like a lady is. But, you know, these are the kind of ideas that I had when I was growing up, and, you know, so here I am. Making these trips to North Philadelphia, and things start happening. Like, guns are getting held to my head, getting robbed in the street. I was on parole in two different states at the end, and I was on house arrest. And I was allowed to go to AA meetings. So at this point, I'm trying different things to get sober. Whatever it is, where they dunk you in the water. I forget what it's called. Clearly, I'm not religious these days, but they dunk me in water, and, like, that was supposed to fix me. And like, it did for a short time. Like, for a short time, I was, like, you know, real fired up. You know, I had a purpose in my life, but I didn't follow up with any action. You know, I was on national TV on the special once in my hometown telling people that Jesus Christ was the way to stay sober, and I wasn't even sober doing it. You know, I told you I'm from a small hometown. At the end of my story, I became a poster child of what not to do with your life. They used to take me out of jail when I'd be in my orange little jumpsuit, shackled and handcuffed, and put me in front of a group of Boy Scouts. And make me tell my story. Like we do here, but I wasn't offering any solution. You know, I was just telling them what happened to put me in jail, essentially. And, you know, when I walk into a scenario like that, like, I would know half the room. I would know half those parents. It's a small town. And, you know, and I hate it, but what are you going to do when the DEA comes in your cell and drags you out? You know what I mean? Like, there's no argument there. And so that's just what I'd become. I'd walk down the street of my hometown, and people would cross and go to the other side of the street because people didn't want to be near me. His family wanted nothing to do with me. My family wanted nothing to do with me. If my grandmother would give me a ride somewhere, she'd pick her purse up that was in the middle of the two front seats and put it between her and the door because you couldn't trust me. I couldn't be near your stuff. You know, I didn't have any friends. They were long gone. They didn't want nothing to do with me. I went from a size 12 to a size 4 in 1 year. I got a disease out there, so I was looking yellow. Actually, I bypassed yellow. I was looking gray by the time I got sober. So I'm looking like this. I'm gray. I haven't eaten or showered in a really long time, and I think I'm looking good. And I'm on parole in two different states. I'm on house arrest. And I decided it's a good idea to go on the run and move to North Philly. Because clearly that's my problem. I just live way too far away from the city. And, you know, I got to tell you, being a country girl and finding the big city was a big deal for me. Like, when I rolled up into the ghettos and, you know, people would be sitting there with their paper bags drinking their 40s of oldie and throwing dice and throwing spades, like, the loud hip-hop music and all the bartenders on the corners. Like, I thought I had arrived. It was... You know, Bill Wilson says in his story that he came to a point where he felt like he'd arrived. And that's how I felt. You know, when I read Bill Wilson's story and I read that line, I was like, oh my God, I remember that feeling. I remember being like, oh my God, why didn't they tell me about this place? And my whole life just revolved around the drink. You know, so I moved down there thinking, clearly that'll fix everything. Yeah, right. And so I saw my little ankle bracelet and get down there and I take up residence. And now I call it a crack house, but I got to tell you, it was a step up from a crack house because I actually had to pay someone $30 to hang out there for a week. And that's what I did. Like, I would go out and I would work the streets and do what I had to do to get enough money just to drink all day long and all night long and stay in this place. I was existing. I was just living the drink. It wasn't fun. I wasn't having a good time. I wasn't happy. I wasn't being of service. I was just existing. And when I think back to that, because I can remember that room, I can remember the way it smelled, I can remember all the gunshots every night long, I can remember the orange extension cord that went out the window to get electricity into the building, the urine stink of that place, I can remember it so clearly, and I remember the misery, how awful I felt on the inside. Because what happened for me at this point in my story is I'd lost all hope. I didn't think someone like me could ever get sober. I'd been trying for years. I'd been out of rehabs and I'd been sitting in meetings. And my perception of meetings obviously was very far off, but I thought it was just a bunch of old people sitting around a table bitching about their day. And now, I've got to be honest, I don't know if I ever went to them sober. So I don't really know if that's what was going on there. But that's what I told all of you. And AA didn't work for me. And I'm down here and living in the ghetto, and I'm so tired. I'm so tired. I don't want to do it anymore. And I felt like this before, but something was different this time. Like, I had no self-respect left. I didn't have any ideas anymore. And there was a payphone across the street, and I'd want to so badly pick that phone up and call my mom and let her know her little girl was okay. My mom got a phone call in the middle of the night before asking her to come identify a body. I knew she didn't want another one of those phone calls. You know, and I already told you guys that when I was growing up, like, I wanted to make my mom proud. I really did. And I wanted so badly to pick that phone up and call her. But she was best friends with my parole officer. So I couldn't really call her and tell her where I was. So I don't know about you guys, but when I'm looking at that payphone and all those feelings are going through me and I get that little glimpse of like what I'm really doing with myself, I don't know what to do with that. So I go drink. And so I'm coming to every morning, I'm bum and change from the bums who are walking around bum and change in the morning. And I get myself enough money to get a 40 of oldie. And I force that 40 of oldie down and I go get what I really need to get to do what I really need to do. Just to survive. Just to survive one day. And every day I'm putting as much stuff in my body, praying to God that it just don't come to. Please, God, let it take me out because I just can't do this anymore. I wanted out. It wasn't like, woohoo, I'm going to get sober in AA. Like, I was done. I could have died and been okay. I would have been okay with it. You know, and to be honest, I really thought I was going to die. I mean, things were happening and I'm surprised I'm still alive today. And so what happened is him is still in my life, God knows why, but he came down for his latest shipment, and he's looking at me with that look of disgust. That look of disgust I get from my parents, my family, loved ones, people who are close to me. It was the first time I was getting it from the person who was by my side living the life that I was living. And I don't know why it made such a difference, but apparently it did. Apparently whatever was left, that look took it away. And I remember he looked out the window and he was like, God, please help us. And I need to make it clear that I didn't ask God for help. I didn't want help. I didn't want to get sober. I just wanted out. And I know now today, being a sober member in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I did my part. I was just right for God. And so what happened is 12 hours later, I'm in my hometown in a hotel, and I don't remember making a decision to get in the car and go back there that night. I knew the feds were in town. I knew I was under investigation again. and knew I was on parole in two different states, and the parole officers were now looking for me. Like, clearly going to this small town was not a good idea. I knew this. But here I am. I come to, and I'm in this hotel room in my hometown, and these people that are dressed in black from head to toe, and they got big fancy guns, are coming in the door, and they're coming in the window, and it wasn't my first run-in with people like this. And, you know, they kicked the door in first, so I tried to jump out the window, and as I was trying to jump out, I see that the guy was coming in, and clearly if you're in a hotel room, there isn't really anywhere else you can run. And so I just kind of remember I fell to the ground. And, it was almost like in that moment, when I fell to the ground, I surrendered. But I didn't know it at that time. You know, I'm sorry, it just hit me that 6 years ago this time is when I was walking the streets homeless down in North Philly. And it's been a long journey from there to here. So here I am, I'm going back to jail, and got a lot of new charges, and I got a lot of parole violations. It looks like I'm going away to do some real time. I've done a lot of county bids. County bids are, I mean, whatever, 30 days. You kind of get used to it. You get your little routine, and it's just a matter of counting down the days. But going upstate was a big deal to me. I was really scared. And, you know, I was probably half the size then that I am now. And I was a little worried about what those big girls were going to do to me up there. And, you know, and so I'm filled with fear. I'm scared to death. And I can't figure out why. I can't figure out how I ended up in the place that I was in. And I was looking back over my life, and I never meant for any of this to happen. You know, last I can remember, I was just a girl in high school drinking and having a good time. And here I am. My life's a disaster. I'm obviously, you know, not anything for my family to be proud of. And I had no idea. I had no idea what I was going to do, what was going to happen, and I was actually kind of pissed because I wanted to be dead. And so I sat my time, and I finally went back to the judge for the final big sentencing. And I don't know why, and I don't know how, but I got sent to a recovery house in York, Pennsylvania. And I got to tell you, I shouldn't have. I should not have. A lot of my friends got 30 to life in prison for doing fed time, and all my friends who got state time, some of them are just now finally being paroled. They got, you know, 7 to 10. And it's a miracle. It's a complete miracle that that I'm standing here today sober. So him got sent up state to prison, and I need to make this clear that I really think that in order for me to get sober, he had to be removed. Because I wasn't just sick about alcohol, I was sick about this guy. You know, my whole life revolved around him and drinking. And so that's just the way that it was. So I get sent to this recovery house in York, Pennsylvania. And, you know, I remember driving there and, you know, I thought I was going to New York. New York's a cool city, right? And so when you find out you're going to York, Pennsylvania, you get a little disappointed about that, and so here I am in York, Pennsylvania, and my parole officers, you know, politely remind me that I need to be grateful and that I'm no longer making decisions in my own life, but this is the way that it is. And so, you know, I get to this recovery house, and I don't even know how to get to the nearest store to get a pack of cigarettes. You know, like, I have no idea where I'm at, and so the house has these rules. It's not rules of AA, it's rules of the house, and the house, you have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I had 30 days to get a home group and a sponsor, and they gave me 2 weeks to get a full-time job. I thought that was a little much. It's been a very long time since I worked full-time. I don't even know if I ever worked full-time, to be honest, up till that point. I rolled into this recovery house with a plastic bag, and that plastic bag had, you know, a lot of shampoo and, you know, soap, things like that. My mom went to Walmart and picked all this stuff up for me. Wasn't like I had, you know, a lot of worldly possessions when I got sent to the rooms of AA. Clearly wasn't old enough, really, to gather a lot of things, so there wasn't much for me to lose. But I'm here, I am in this house, I don't know where I'm at, I don't know what I'm doing, so I do what I do. I find the sickest him that I can find who was just out of jail, and we could relate, and, you know, I did everything that you people told me not to do. You know, you guys, you know, told me not to get up in your meetings. I was the girl getting up in the middle of your meeting, making all that noise back there at the coffee. In one of the meetings I went to, in particular, was a smoking meeting. You could go down in the basement and smoke. And so, you know, I'm getting up halfway through the meeting and getting all my little friends to get up, too, and go down and smoke. And, you know, and I was just showing up, looking cute, trying to get everyone to notice me. Because I don't know that there's something wrong with me. I don't know that I have a hole in the soul. I don't know that I'm trying to use your attention to make myself feel better about myself. Like, I don't know these things. I don't know that I'm sick and that I have a problem. Like, I'm just doing what I think I'm supposed to do. And, you know, so I'm showing up to your meetings late. I'm being rude and obnoxious all through the meeting. I'm leaving early because I don't want to hold your hand and say the prayer. You know, I'm going to all the little dances, all your little cookouts. I'm doing all this stuff, and I think that I am an active member of AA, right? And 30 days later, my little boyfriend's back in jail. This girl that had become my best friend was back on the corner turning tricks. And I remember going to sleep at night, and it was like my brain would just wake up. You know, and I would do that where you look at the clock every hour, and you're like, well, if I fall asleep now, I can get 5 hours of sleep. You toss and turn some more, and you're like, okay, well, if I fall asleep now, I'll get 4 hours of sleep. And, you know, and my mind's just going a mile a minute. Like I told you before, when I first got up here, what my mind's like when I can't sleep at night. It's just going on and on. I got 10 scenarios of one scenario going on up there all at the same time, and I really, truly start to think that I'm crazy. I really thought that I was crazy. I didn't know that it was alcoholism. I hadn't met someone who sat down with me and explained to me the doctor's opinion and told me what alcoholism was. And then if I just followed their lead and tossed up to Alcoholics Anonymous, like it's laid out in the big book, that everything would be different, if you will. And so, you know, I don't know what's wrong with me. I think I'm going crazy. And I remember that next morning. I was sitting at the kitchen table drinking a cup of coffee, and I remember just, you know, wanting to pull my hair out, and, you know, I gotta tell you, I'm working at Chuck E. Cheese, right? I'm hosting birthday parties. I'm 23 years old. Like, I feel like the biggest loser. And, you know, like, I'm the girl who's getting in the mouth, and all the kids are beating up all day long. Now, untreated alcoholism hanging out in a mouse costume is not a good combination. And, you know, and I'm going crazy, and I just remember pounding my fist down this morning and saying, all right, God, I guess I need a sponsor. Can you show it to me outside of an AA meeting? And I got to tell you guys, I didn't know how to pick a sponsor. You know, I've been watching the rooms because it was a house rule. I had to get one. And I'd asked a few people, and, you know, the one person worked with me for like a week, and then she told me I need to get someone different because I asked her to take me through the steps. And then after that, I was just mortified. It's hard enough to ask someone to sponsor you, but then to have that happen, like, I was scared to death to ask another woman to sponsor me. And so I made this deal with God, and which I don't do anymore, because God answered this one, and he sent a woman to my work that night. And as she walked in, I recognized her face from a meeting, and I don't remember what was said. I don't remember anything special about her. I just remember that she picked me up the next morning at 7 a.m., and I hadn't been up at 7 a.m. in a very, very long time. But I was up and I was showered and I was out on those front steps at 7 a.m. waiting for her to pick me up. And I thought it was supposed to be her and I. We were going to spend a meaningful one-on-one time, and that's not what happened. She pulled up in what I call the nut van. The nut van, they open the side door, the smoke comes rolling out, and you look in, it's full of all these old people. And all these old people, they got their coffees, their cigarettes, they got big books open, and they got these smiles on their face. It's 7 in the morning. What could you possibly be smiling about at 7 in the morning? You know what I mean? So I get in, and I accept a cup of coffee, and I lay out my cigarette, and it's my turn to read, and I tell them that I get car sick, I can't read. I'm like, we don't care if you get car sick, read anyway. These people were mean, and they didn't care what I thought. They didn't care what I had to say. And they didn't really like what I talked at all, actually. And But they knew that I had a disease that was killing me. And they took my life more serious than I was taking my own. And they knew that there were things to do, not things to talk about. And We drove an hour that day to a meeting outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and these two women were there. It was a group's anniversary. And these two women were there from Richmond, Virginia. And they were sharing their experience on the 12 steps out of the Big Book. And so they're up there, they're jumping around, they're making fun of each other, they're laughing, they're carrying on. And this woman's an old hippie. And she told my story to the T, but she kept going 10 years. You know, at the end, she's like in the gothic era with dead flowers in her hair still. And, you know, and so I'm like, oh, my God, like, she's telling my story. But then she proceeded to tell me what she had done. And I could look at these two girls up there, and I could clearly tell that they were happy about being sober, and they weren't lying about it. You know, I'd met people before who told me they were happy about being sober, but their faces didn't say they were happy about being sober. You know what I mean? And but these two people, like, I was just blown away. And what happened for me is sitting in that front row, because I had a sponsor who does this, which means sit. I sat in that front row, and I just remember being like, oh, my God, maybe, just maybe, if I do what they've done, this thing will work for me, too. And I didn't talk to her. I was too afraid. I was too full of fear. I didn't talk for, like, my first 2 years, because I was too afraid of what people thought about me. But the sponsor, she dropped me off that day. She gave me three pieces of paper, and we opened up the Big Book, and she showed me where the outline of the fourth step was, and we read all of it together, where it gives us the directions, the questions to answer, and we read all that stuff together, and she told me I had 1 week to write my inventory. And I wrote it. It's that simple. What I was told to do, I just did an AA. Thank God that God sent me someone that knew what the heck they were doing. You know, she also told me that if I did five things every day, then I never had to feel that way again. She told me every morning I also had to do these five things in order for her to be my sponsor. She told me I had to get on my knees every morning and ask God for help, to help me not take a drink that day. I had to call her every day at 9 a.m. so she could give me directions on the day. She said, don't call me later that day. Tell me what you've already done, because I don't care. And she also told me that I was going to read two pages out of the Big Book. And she turned to the very front. She said, you're going to start with this page, the one that's blank, because that's what I knew about sobriety. Ha, ha, ha. And then she told me I was going to meet her every day at 6:30 to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meetings didn't start till 8:30. And then she would drop me off. I had to walk to meet her, but she would drop me off. And then when I get home, she told me to get back on my knees and thank God for keeping me sober that day. And I'm here to tell you that from that day till this, I've been doing those five things. I've been doing what that woman taught me to do. And here I am. So, here I am a week later. We're doing this this big four step. You know, and this is the deal with inventory, right? My sponsor said, Jessica, get on your knees and ask God for help and put the pen to the paper and start writing. And so that's what I did. And what happened is I'm writing this stuff out, and I'm like, gosh, some of this is kind of silly. And then when I met with her, I thought, once again, see my thinking, right? I thought that we were going to have this meaningful one-on-one experience, and she was going to say some real profound things before we started, and she didn't. She took my hand, and she was like, hi, God, it's so-and-so and Jessica. And I remember thinking in my head, I'm like, that's a funny way to pray. You can't talk to God like that. And, you know, because I'm praying, like, with these and thous, and, you know, God's way out there, and she's talking to God like he's right there in the car between us. And I was just, nothing was making sense to me at this point. And so we go, we sit at this picnic table. It's a beautiful, bright day. Not a cloud on the horizon. And, just kidding about that part. But it was a beautiful, sunny day. And I didn't notice time, but a little later I would, you know, perk up and see this. And so I set my papers down. She said, okay, start reading. So I start reading, essentially. And then I'm saying this stuff out loud now. I'm like, wow, it's really silly, but really, truly silly. And so I try to skip some of them because they're just so pathetic. And she's like, yeah, skipped a few. And, you know, I had her on there and my sponsor on there. Her sponsor was really me. So I heard her sponsor on there. And she's like, you skipped a few more. And You know, and so my first inventory, it was kind of like puking. I just dumped a bunch of shit. You know, oh, sorry. I just dumped a bunch of crap. You know what I mean? And, but what happened is I shared every deep, dark secret that I had in here. Everything that I thought made me so different from you. And what happened is she had it all too. She had done it all too. And when I found out that I really wasn't this big old badass that I thought I was, you know, I really was just a little scared country girl. And, you know, but I like thought that I was like big time city girl. And you know, and well, I'm just this little country girl. And sometimes I still like to think I'm a big city girl, but I'm not at all. You know, and so at the end of that, this is what happened. We got done reading everything. She got done, you know, she told me that, that I'm not what I had done, that I was just one of God's kids, and that God loved me no matter what. And I never heard anyone talk about God quite like that before. You know, I thought God was like, had this book, and he was keeping track of all my wrongs, and he was going to judge me someday, and real serious stuff, you know what I mean? And I was scared of God. And what happened is my idea of God started to change that day. She introduced a concept of this loving God. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm just blown away by this experience. I think now that it was like, I was really blown away by this idea of God. And she looked at me, and she was like, what's going on? And sponsors like to ask trick questions, right? And so, like, I'm trying really hard to come up with the right answer, and, like, my brain won't work. You know, any other time I got 10 voices going on up there. This time there's nothing. And I'm like, oh, my God, oh, my gosh, she thinks I'm an idiot. Think of something, like, nothing's happening. And I was like, I don't know. And she said, welcome to Serenity. And I couldn't believe it. I've been saying the Serenity Prayer for years. I never had a clue what the word meant. You know, and I was starting to experience it. So what happened is this. On page 25 of the big book, talks about a rocket trip. Talks about being rocketed into a fourth dimension. And what happened for me is that day is my rocket took off. You know, things got a little brighter. I could hold my head a little higher. I could look you in the eye. You know, and I started to become happy about being sober. So I'd been faced with the truth about me, and I wasn't at all what I thought I was. I thought I was a sweet little innocent girl, and I clearly wasn't. And so, you know, I got sent home to do 6 and 7. And 6 and 7, my first experience around, was kind of funny because I didn't get that I was supposed to review the first 5 steps. You know, I read where I said review the first 5 proposals, but I didn't get what that meant, so I kind of just, like, skipped that line and just sat and thought about me for an hour. And, you know, and I know now it's the first 5 steps, but I didn't know that then, so I just sat there and I thought about me and me some more. And, but what happened is I didn't like the truth about Jessica. I didn't like that girl. I didn't want to be her. You know, and so 6 and 7 was kind of like this for me. I was like, God, I don't like that girl. I really don't want to be her. I don't know what I want to be. So I'll be the clay and you be the potter. And just do whatever you want with me. You know, and that's kind of how prayer has been for me from that day till this. I'm just kind of like, God, I don't really know. Do what you want. Just let me know, so I know what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, I try not to make demands on God or tell God how he should arrange things or whatever. You know, I just want to be open for what God wants for me today. You know, up until that point in my life, like, that was the best I had. That was the best thinking. That was the best ideas Jessica had on life. You know, and so when I got introduced to this new idea, this new way of living, if you will, this new idea of God, like, I was like, all right, this could be, you know, like, okay. And I also got to tell you, I'm not the intellectual type. Like, I'm not a thinker at all. You tell me to do it, I just go and do it. I don't have to understand why, I don't have to understand how, and I'm so thankful for that today. I sponsor a lot of girls who are how and why people, and, like, I that kind of mind would drive me crazy. I just go do it. It's that simple. I don't want what I had, and I don't want to go back there. You know, so the following day when my sponsor told me to write down, or actually, she put some stars by some names when we were doing that inventory, and there were people that I owed some amends to. And I had to add some people to that list But I took that list to her, and we went over the list. She crossed some names off that I clearly thought that I needed to make amends to, but she didn't think those boys would want to see me. And so, you know, the next week I'm out making amends. And not once did I think, well, wait a minute, I think I'm going a little fast. I think we better slow down. I've only been out of jail for 60 days. You know, I was getting happy, and I was excited about it, and I was so thankful that someone was finally telling me what to do to not take a drink for 24 hours. You know, people say, don't take a drink and you're a winner. And I'm like, that's great, but how do you not take a drink? Like, how do you not do that? That's a big deal for us. That's a big deal for me. I'm 23 years old and I can't not take a drink for one day. It's pathetic. And I didn't know. I didn't know it because I had a disease called alcoholism. I didn't know that I had an allergic reaction when I put it in my body and it sets off this obsession in my mind. No wonder it's all I thought about. You know, I had no idea. And so, you know, in the beginning, you know, I didn't have a sponsor who sat down and took me through the book page by page, line for line. You know, they told me what to do and I went and did it. They showed me by example. They taught me how to do this thing. You know, and I got to a point, I guess I was around 3 years sober, where I got with a woman. That actually, that woman that I saw that first meeting that my sponsor took me to, I finally went to that woman and I asked her for help. And we sat down, we went through that book, page for page, line by line. And when it said pray, we pray. When we said to write, we wrote. You know, and things, you know, like I was on fire up until this point. Don't get me wrong. But things started to become alive at this point in my sobriety. Things got animated for me. You know, I was sponsoring girls, but I was real controlling. You know, it was real mean, you know, and I was sponsoring out of fear. And what happened is some of the girls I really cared about and had been sponsoring for like a year all were leaving. And that doesn't feel very good when you get close to people and they leave. And I got pushed back into a corner where I had no choice but to look at me again. You know, and so what happened is I had to go through this process all over again. I had to take another look at Jessica, and I had to do that another inventory. And what happened is this time it wasn't so much puking as it was as with, oh, my God, like, this is really the person I am. These are what my character defects are. You know, it wasn't about not drinking anymore. It was about, you know, putting these principles into action in my life outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can look good and I can sound good standing up here at your podium, but what am I doing when I walk out that door? What am I doing when I walk into the house that I live in with the people that I'm living with? What am I doing when I walk into that front door of that job, assuming that I have one? You know, what am I doing then? You know, am I being the only copy of a big book that some people may see? Am I representing AA to the best that I can? You know, and what happened is around 3 years sober is I got hit with all this stuff. And I was doing a bad job. I was doing a really bad job. And so what happened is 10, 11, and 12 just came full circle for me. I had to really be aware of Jessica and my actions all day long. I had to constantly, God help me, please help me, God. You know, and this may come as good news or bad news for some people, but that's what the whole deal is about, is God. You know, the 12 steps is a design for living so that we can live comfortably, you know, out there in the world. And how do we do that? By having a relationship with God. And if we don't have that, it's going to be a real struggle out there. You know what I mean? If I'm powerless, I need something. I need something to help me out there. Because I don't got the answers. My answers is drinking. And drinking some more and stalking him. You know, that's the best I got. You know, and I come into these rooms and, you know, and I look at these 12 steps and they don't make any sense. But after I go through that process, you know, I have a sponsor who hopefully took my hand and put it in the hand of a loving God. You know, and so I got 2 minutes to tell you what I'm like today. What I'm like today. Let's see. I just moved from Baltimore, Maryland to Bowie, Maryland. And, you know, it's not real far, but it's far enough that everything has changed. There's not one thing in my life that hasn't changed. You know, I moved in with my new him, and my new him is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's active, sponsors a ton of people, and it's great, you know. You know, we talk about God, we're fired up about God, and you know, when you're active in Alcoholics Anonymous, you never run out of things to talk about. And so that area has been wonderful, and You know, and it's all about service. It's all about serving and loving and accepting. And it's been a great lesson. And, you know, I don't have a job because I just moved. And so once again, I'm like, all right, God, what's next? What are we doing? Where are we going? Can you show me? I need a billboard. And you know, and I'm not going to lie, there's days where I get stuck in self-pity. I'm like, oh, my God, how am I going to pay my next month's bills? Like, where's the money coming from? You know, but what I do know is that if I continue to suit up and show up, like you've taught me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, trust God and help others, that things will just unfold. You know, so I'm kind of like in the hallway right now, you know, and I'm excited and I'm waiting. I'm like, all right, which door's next? Where are we going next? What's God got in store? You know, and I'm excited and fired up. And I'm, you know, life's not a struggle today. I'm not miserable. I'm not like, you know, well, yesterday I didn't want to get out of bed, but that's just because I was full of self-pity yesterday, you know what I mean? And then, like, today I get up and I'm, like, fired up about life, you know? And when I do what you people have taught me, life's different. And that's what my sponsor told me in the beginning. She said, if I did this stuff, that my life would be different. And with that, I am out of time, and Billy, thanks for having me.